From Trinity College, this is Hidden Literacies. Welcome to Hidden Literacies, the podcast. On this show, we'll get a chance to hear from contributors to Hidden Literacies, the anthology. I'm Mary Mahoney, the Digital Scholarship Coordinator at Trinity College. On this episode, we'll talk to two archivists at institutions contributing items to Hidden Literacies: Eileen Frank, Chief Curator at the Connecticut Historical Society, and Christina Blyer, Director of Special Collections and Archives at Trinity College's Watkinson Library. We discuss the roles archives play in preservation, whose stories they allow us to tell, and what digitizing items like those in our anthology can mean for people invested in exploring our shared past. Some months ago, while preparing this podcast, I had the chance to visit the Connecticut Historical Society and talk with the chief curator, Eileen Frank. When I arrived, Eileen gave me a behind-the-scenes tour. Together, we descended the stairs to the basement, and I realized I was getting to experience every archive lover's dream. I got to see all the stuff. Eileen showed me aisles of portraits, centuries old, hung on shelves with care. Dated fashions worn by Connecticut residents long dead, and rows upon rows of archival boxes holding papers that might reveal untold stories. Afterwards, we returned to her office for a conversation about archives and preservation. In my conversation with Eileen, and later with Christina Blyer, it was clear so much of the work in archives and museum collections is about making collections accessible to the public, either by digitizing collections for those who could not travel to CHS for a tour, for example, or by altering how and what institutions collect. As we'll hear, for so long, many archives and museums collected in areas that reflected the privileged patrons who founded their organizations and kept them going. Now, institutions like CHS and the Watkinson are leading the way in making their spaces accessible by preserving histories of underrepresented groups, communicating through their exhibit work that visitors may discover objects and texts in their collections that reflect their own stories. As representatives of two of the archival homes of texts in the Hidden Literacies anthology, Eileen and Christina can help us think about the importance of archives and special collections, and of the digitization efforts that helped make possible work like Hidden Literacies. In our conversation, Eileen Frank described early experiences that led her to a career in museum education.
I spent a lot of time in museums as a child and just loved them and found them really fascinating. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C., so we were always at the Smithsonian and at the zoo and at the Children's Museum, and they were kind of like my playground.
These experiences informed her own sense of wonder in the archives as she discovered items she'd never encountered before.
I have moments that I've had myself, which are amazing. I've been at this job now for 4 years, and the collection here, because we were founded in 1825 and started actively collecting in the late 1830s, and so we predate organizations like the National Archive and the Smithsonian. We have documents related to the early founding of our nation and you know, the colonial period that are really impressive. And so the first time that I held a letter written by George Washington is this moment of I'm holding a letter written by George Washington. You know, you just have this immense moment of ridiculousness, quite honestly, that this piece of paper has survived, that it was held by someone who we continue to talk about and raise up, and look at the complexity of his life.
In her work at Connecticut Historical Society, Eileen gets to help researchers have similar moments of discovery.
I had a researcher from the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston who is looking at one woman's needlework. And so we pulled out these pieces that her work is held at minimally three different museums. The MFA has some of her work, Fairfield Museum has some of her work, and we do. And we were looking at this item, and you could see how the stitches changed. There were some areas that were really tight and really well formed, and the stitch count was super, super high. And then there were areas where it wasn't as refined. And to be with this scholar who knew so much about it and could show me these things, and then I learned, and then, you know, sort of hypothesizing that maybe the woman who's been credited with this work was teaching someone else. You know, maybe there was another hand that was involved, that you could start seeing that there were more than one person who were doing these stitches. That was a pretty awesome moment.
But as she notes, archives are not sites of discovery and curiosity solely for researchers or museum educators.
Anytime I have someone who's doing family history and they get to an item that connects them to a relative, and they see that great-great-grandfather signature, or they see a photograph, or they hold a needlework that was done by a distant female relative. And all of a sudden, those names that have been on a family tree become real people. I will never get tired of that moment.
For some, the surprise discovery of loved ones in the archive contradicts received notions that archives exist solely to preserve the histories of elites, that it's a space for George Washington's papers, but not your parents. As Christina Blyer describes, watching patrons stumble on connections in the archive speaks both to their power as meaning-making spaces and to the need for inclusive collecting. Here she shares a story about introducing a class to the papers of noted Chicana theorist Gloria Anzaldúa.
Before coming to Trinity, I was the head of special collections and archives at the Benson Latin American Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. They house the Gloria Anzaldúa archives, all of her papers, journals, artwork, everything. And so I was doing an introduction to her archive with a group of English students. We were looking at all of her personal and biographical materials. So things like birth certificates, school yearbooks, graduation certificates, diplomas, things like that. And one thing that we look at, Anzaldúa wrote a story, a short story called Her Name Never Got Called. And in there, she talks about how when she goes to school, they call her name Gloria, and she doesn't reply because her mother always called her Prieta or Prietita. And so she didn't know her name was Gloria, so she didn't respond. And then the teacher ended up hitting her because she didn't respond to her name, and she got in trouble. And she thought, oh my gosh, my parents are going to be so mad at me, but I didn't know my name was Gloria. And so the students do an exercise where they look at her birth certificate, and they look at her yearbook, and they look at her high school diploma. And it's really interesting because on all three of those official documents, her name is misspelled, or they have the complete wrong name. So, for example, on her high school diploma, it says Evan Anzaldúa. And because her name is Gloria Evangelina Anzaldúa, somehow they got Evan from that. So we're looking through the yearbooks and looking through all of these documents. And one of the students was from the border, from the same town, I guess. And so he went to the yearbook and he's flipping through. And it so happened that his mother was in the class, like one class ahead of Anzaldúa. And so the student was like so thrilled, right? Because on a number of different levels, this just struck him. One, never thought that anyone from his town, you know, Gloria Anzaldúa, of course, is famous and important, but he never thought, you know, that he would see his mother represented in an archive. He never thought that he would see other people that he knew from his town there in this archive, represented in the yearbook, having written messages to Gloria. And so this was a really powerful experience for him. He asked to go out in the hall, and he called immediately. He called his mother and said, "You'll never believe what I just saw," and took photos and texted it to her.
For Christina, This speaks to an important point about the role archives can play in people's lives as sites of inclusion.
I think this was really powerful for me to see because it showed me the importance of making sure that diverse groups of people are represented in archives and the importance of being able to see your history and connect with your history in archives.
Archives were not always dedicated to being inclusive, as both Eileen and Christina can attest. Eileen described complications of not centering inclusivity in preserving histories of the suffrage movement.
There's a real question about how do we confront the fact that our holdings are not representative of everyone's history. And that is something that is really important for the field to be aware of and for the public to be aware of. We have a situation right now where 2020 will be the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment and women's suffrage. And we know people who are working on commemorating this anniversary across the nation, we know that people of color, women of color, were involved in that movement. Doing the work to unbury those histories is a challenge because that information wasn't saved in the same way that the information was saved about the middle class and upper middle class white women who were seen as the leaders of the movement. And so even though now, as we want to commemorate this 100th anniversary, and we want to raise up the stories, it is hard to find the material evidence to support those stories. I think that a lot of that evidence just doesn't exist in official repositories and that we have to go to families and ask what they still have in their family collections. We have to think about different places. Maybe there's archives that are held in houses of worship, you know, that are not the state historical society or the state library. But just the fact that those archives don't exist doesn't mean that history didn't happen. And so it's really important to keep that in mind and know that that is a huge discrepancy in our holdings.
This is why digitizing materials can be so important. It can connect people to materials they otherwise would not have access to. As Christina explains, the ability to travel to archives to do research is a privilege and has long mostly been the privilege of elites.
You know, in the past, especially, archives and special collections were something maybe just for the elite, right? They're the ones that had the time to go sit in an archive for a week and do research. They could afford to travel to whatever archive to go do the research.
New methods of digitization and curation are changing whose stories get archived, the degree to which communities can maintain control over where and how their materials get archived, and who has access to them. As Christina explains, post or non-custodial digitization and collecting is one such method.
There is a number of ways that I think digitization is changing the ways that archives are curated because, when I was at UT, we did a lot of what we called and I think is now being called either post-custodial or non-custodial archiving. And so this is where you leave the collection, no matter what it is, the papers, or any kind of records, whatever, but you leave it in the community where it was created. So in the past, if you wanted to acquire an archive, you had to bring it. You had to physically bring the archive to the repository, process it, do the finding aid, all of that. But because of digitization now, you can leave the archive in the community where it was created. And then the way that we did it at UT was that we would train the community members to do the digitization, and they would also be the people that were collecting the metadata for the collection because they know the most about it. So in that sense, the community maintains both physical and intellectual control of the material.
Digitization brings with it new challenges. Younger researchers not taught cursive in school struggle to read it in the archive, for example. But digitization can offer new ways of sharing and accessing collections, even as in-person research still holds its own charms.
I just believe that there's a power in the real object there, whether it's that emotional connection or you gain, your senses are just used differently when you can see the ink on that paper or even touch the paper or get that smell of old paper. But what the digitization can do is it can improve readability. You know, you can make things bigger and blow them up. You can play with contrast.
These trends reflect a greater awareness among archives and special collections groups of the need for greater accessibility, both of all communities to these spaces and for the need to digitize and make accessible collections grounded in a physical space. Doing this work contributes to an intention Eileen refers to as, quote, lifting everyone's stories up. But that intention comes with complications. For example, what role does consent and privacy play in digitizing collections? As Eileen describes, in some cases, not all subjects in archives were offered the right to give consent to have their image or story preserved.
Consent is a huge issue that we're wrestling with now. You know, people participated and had things in newsletters are a great example, or photographs of like marches and stuff where people who were in those marches in the 70s, 80s, even in the 90s had no concept. I had no concept in the 90s of what social media would look like today and the real negative side of social media. And so, of course, there's a fear of if you put a photo of me attending a rally, you know, whether abortion rights or gay rights, or that could put me out there to have a negative attack come at me now. I mean, that's a real question around privacy.
In other cases, specifically within the indigenous communities some of our contributors either belong to and or study, some knowledge is not meant to be shared outside the community, complicating digitization projects or preservation practices linked to public access. This project respects these traditions as it offers a digitized anthology from which researchers, teachers, and curious readers may share in texts both known and unknown, and think with the stories our contributors found there. In the episodes that follow, you'll hear from our contributors about the texts they've contributed to Hidden Literacies and what they make of them. Hidden Literacies is a production of Trinity College, edited by Hilary Wiss and Christopher Hager, with support from the English Department and Information Services, with technical support by Mary Mahoney, Joelle Thomas, and Kate Kennedy. This podcast was produced by me, Mary Mahoney, with the support and permission of the contributors to Hidden Literacies. For more information on Hidden Literacies and to explore the texts and commentaries described here, please visit www.hiddenliteracies.org.